Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Okay, let's jump right into this deep dive. Today, we are wrestling with a really challenging and honestly profoundly moving novel, Stephen Graham Jones's The Only Good Indians. For you, our listener, this is kind of your shortcut to understanding why this book has become such a landmark text.
Oh, absolutely. It's essential reading, I think. It really blurs the lines between, literary fiction, horror, and indigenous studies.
Yeah.
Stephen Graham Jones, he's a member of the Blackfeet Nation, and he's just doing incredible work here, crafting something that feels ancient and hyper-modern at the same time.
That blending is the key, isn't it? He's not just writing a standard horror novel. He's mixing in traditional Blackfeet storytelling elements, specifically that concept of sacred reciprocity, with some truly visceral, like, modern-day terror.
Exactly. And the mission for us today, really, is to unpack the whole storyline, from the original sin, you could call it, right through to the maybe surprising resolution.
And connect it all back.
Yeah, connect it all back to those core themes.
Yeah.
Cultural identity, vengeance, and just the inescapable weight of history.
Okay, so let's start with the hook. The core premise is almost... yeah, mythical, like you said. Four American Indian friends, Blackfeet Nation, 10 years ago, they did something unforgivable, a transgression.
A big one.
And now that past is literally hunting them. Some sources even mention an alternate title, The Buffalo Hunters.
Right, which kind of perfectly captures that central conflict, doesn't it? The hunters becoming the hunted.
Totally.
And it wasn't just like a regulatory mistake, oh, they hunted on the wrong day or something. It was a deep moral and cultural violation.
Okay.
And if we're looking at the bigger picture, context-wise, Jones's novel really flips that old horror trope, you know, the Indian burial ground thing.
Right.
Here, the terror doesn't come from some external curse. It stems from an internal wound, a self-inflicted one, really, against their own traditions.
So let's really detail that original sin, because the specifics, they matter a lot here. It happened on a cold Thanksgiving day.
Mm-hmm.
The four friends, Lewis, Gabe, Cass, and Ricky, they trespass onto restricted reservation land, elders' land.
Right.
And driven by what the book calls youthful arrogance, they did something truly shocking. They didn't just hunt an elk. They slaughtered almost a dozen, the entire herd.
Wiped them out.
Yeah.
And the problem wasn't just the overhunting, though that was bad enough. It was the waste.
Yeah.
This just completely violated that core principle of the hunter-prey relationship. The idea that the animal gives its life, sure, but only if its life is used.
Like,
fully, respectfully.
And then the ultimate transgression, the detail that like the whole entity is built on, killing that young pregnant calf.
That's the heart of it.
And the imagery the book uses, and this is brutal. Lewis feeling the unborn calf kicking against his knife blade, that moment just it solidifies it, doesn't it?
It really does.
It's cruelty aimed right at the future, life itself.
Precisely. And that specific act of cruelty against a pregnant mother is what births the antagonist, the Elkhead woman.
Right.
And she isn't just some generic movie monster. If you ask, like, why frame the vengeance as maternal fury, specifically maternal?
Yeah, why?
It's because the crime was against motherhood, against life. So she embodies natural law, pushing back, demanding, well, a symmetric debt. And an eye for an eye, almost.
It sets up that theme of sacred reciprocity right away, the idea that actions ripple out, you know, and disrespecting the land, its creatures.
Mm-hmm.
It demands a price, a terrifying personal price.
And that payment starts hitting the guys who tried hardest to run from who they are. Let's look at Lewis Clark first. He's the protagonist of the first section.
Right.
And you see his guilt really manifesting through his attempts at assimilation.
Lewis is the one who ran the fastest, right? Tried to build this whole stable life off the reservation.
Exactly.
He's got the postal job. He married a white woman, PETA. He seems to genuinely believe that if he just acts white enough, maybe the trauma, the past, it just won't touch him.
Yeah, and his story becomes this just tragic takedown of that whole fantasy. Meanwhile, we learn that Ricky Boss Ribs, the first of the four, he's already dead before the main story kicks off.
Right. His death was sort of dismissed, wasn't it? Like racist violence outside a bar.
Initially, yeah. But it's later revealed. No, that was the entity's first move.
Yeah.
Calculated, supernatural.
Yep.
The debt collector was already on the job.
So then Lewis's descent starts. And this is where the book just shifts into this pure, suffocating psychological horror. It's subtle first.
Mm-hmm. Little cracks in reality.
He sees flashes of elk on the road. Then, bam, a pair of elk standing right there on his living room rug.
Jones is just fantastic at internalizing that fear.
Hmm.
Lewis is haunted by these, like, fleeting visions. You're not sure, is it guilt? Is it real?
Blurring the line.
Yeah, totally. Then the horror becomes external. His dog killed meticulously, horrifically, mirroring the disrespect shown to the elk herd all those years ago.
And then the physical manifestation, the Elkhead woman, she appears often as this beautiful native woman, right? But she has that one telltale detail.
The yellow tassel.
Yeah, mirroring the tag they put on the dead elk's ear 10 years back. It's like her calling card. Links her right to the crime.
It ties the consequence directly, visually, back to that moment of violation. It's the sign that says, yep, the past found you.
And Lewis's final confrontation, it's devastating. He realizes that trying to assimilate, trying to wall off his past, it actually made him more vulnerable. That section climaxes in this really brutal, claustrophobic scene. In his own home, he fights the entity, but it's just overwhelming.
It was too much.
And in this moment of just utter tragedy, his wife, Peeta, gets caught in the crossfire. She's killed. And that confirms Lewis's worst fear. The vengeance isn't just for him.
No.
The payment is generational. It touches everyone close to the transgressor.
Lewis's failure is absolutely a thematic cornerstone. His attempts to deny his culture, run from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what seals his fate, ultimately. He died trying to live this illusion of escape.
So the narrative snaps back immediately to the Blackfeet Reservation, to the two remaining friends, Gabe Crossguns and Cast Iron Shell.
Right.
Gabe's still reckless, works the oil rigs. You can just see the guilt eating him up. Cass, he seems the most grounded. He's desperate, mainly, to protect his teenage daughter, Denora.
And for Gabe and Cass, the fear is communal now. It's not just personal hauntings. They realize this entity is real, it's unstoppable, and it's just working its way down the list.
Systematically.
Yeah. So they pivot. Dramatically, they turn back to traditional practices of protection. They're looking for a spiritual fix for a spiritual crime.
Which brings us to that absolutely terrifying central sequence, the Sweat Lodge ceremony.
Oh, man.
They bring in elders, Shaney and Victor, for a purification ritual. They're seeking sanctuary and tradition this time.
But this is where Jones delivers a real thematic gut punch. You have to ask.
Yeah.
Why let this sacred space, this traditional sanctuary, be violated so horribly?
Why?
The answer, I think, is profound. Conventional protections don't work when the transgression itself was against traditional law. Their crime poisoned the well, basically. Poisoned the very system they're now trying to use for cleansing.
So it just turns into a bloodbath. The entity gets inside the pitch-black lodge. Shoney is gored by an elk that seems to just manifest right out of the steam and shadows.
It's horrifying. Truly imaginative terror that completely flips the purpose of the lodge on its head.
And the horror that follows, the entity starts wearing Shoney's skin.
Yeah, moving among them, undetected.
It just reinforces that theme of inversion, doesn't it? An inescapable terror. The hunters are now hunted by something wearing the face of their own community.
Exactly.
And this is the point where the men finally grasp the full symmetrical horror of the entity's justice, the original crime. Killing a pregnant mother and her unborn calf. The justice demanded a child for a child. The next target is Denora, Cass's daughter.
And this shift brings in that critical theme of generational trauma, accountability. The sins of the fathers are literally being visited on the daughter.
Who had nothing to do with it?
Nothing at all. Denora represents the future generation. Her fate really dictates whether this whole cycle of vengeance can possibly be broken.
Jones uses such a brilliant contemporary setting for the climax, too. Denora's high school championship basketball game.
Yeah.
Which, for many indigenous communities, basketball is way more than just a sport, right? It's a symbol of modern resilience, community, identity.
It's her sacred space, absolutely.
So as the entity, disguised as Shinny, closes in, the two remaining men, Gabe and Cass, they make their final sacrifices. Redemptive ones, maybe?
You can see it that way. Gabe, kind of accepting his fate, lures the entity away. Into the snow, buys time.
The cast dies trying to shield Denora, too.
Leaving Denora alone.
Yeah.
The final girl, but with this deep cultural twist.
But the resolution. This is where the novel offers real thematic hope, I think. She doesn't grab a gun or try to fight it with force.
No, she does something completely unexpected.
Yeah.
She challenges the Elkhead woman to a one-on-one basketball game.
Which sounds almost absurd, but it's the key moment we need to focus on. Why basketball?
Because Denora meets this ancient force, this primal vengeance, not with denial or violence, but with a modern act of reverence.
She uses her own skill, her own identity marker.
Exactly. She acknowledges the entity's grief, the loss of its calf, and she honors that spirit by meeting it on her terms, in her sacred space. She's proving her worth, her connection through her integrated identity, not through escape.
And that acceptance, that recognition,
mm.
rather than fighting or denying, that's what finally causes the entity to recede, to break the cycle.
Yeah. Denora's survival suggests a path forward, doesn't it? That tradition and modernity aren't mutually exclusive. They can be integrated. And that healing comes through acknowledgement, through accountability, not through destruction or trying to forget.
So what does this all really mean for us, for you, the listener? I think the only good Indians forces you to fundamentally empathize with the monster.
It really does.
The lines between righteous justice and terrible revenge get so blurred until you realize the entity is just. The consequence of breaking a sacred promise.
And if we connect that to the bigger picture, the novel tells us that accountability, it goes beyond just individual guilt, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It ties into generational patterns, ecological disrespect, our whole relationship with the land.
Yeah.
Maybe Jones is suggesting that our deepest connection to the natural world, sometimes it's forged through shared trauma, through that necessary, painful acceptance of consequences.
It leaves you thinking about justice, vengeance, and how the past never really stays buried. A powerful, haunting book.
Absolutely. It lingers long after you finish it. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by A. Katra Foundation.